Now, this weekend's conference is entitled Marxism for Beginners. And there could hardly be, I think, a better way, a better place to start than with Karl Marx's investigations into how and why human society changes. Historical materialism was a scientific theory first developed by Karl Marx and often referred to as the MCH, or the materialist conception of history. Now, to revolutionary socialists, this concept is not some sort of abstract philosophical argument, but an important key, a method of explaining how the present social system of capitalism developed out of previous social systems as part of an historic evolutionary process. More importantly, however, historical materialism is not only concerned with understanding how we came to be where we are now, it can play a much more vital role in helping us to see what the future could be were we to consciously organize collectively to make it happen. Now, by applying this outlook to human affairs, the Socialist Party is materialist, and unrepentantly so. And to make this point clear, we have, for the first of our sessions today, two speakers to give a talk on historical materialism, its theory and action. To begin with, Steve Coleman will argue why socialists think that history is still relevant in explaining the real world of today, nearing the close of the 20th century. And following on from this, Janie Percy Smith is going to examine Marx's theory of social development in a little bit of detail and explain just what his theory of history actually was. Now, afterwards, we will have a discussion period, and we hope for some interesting, lively comments and questions from you, the audience. So that's a lot from me at the moment. I'll hand straight over to Steve to start.
Well, thank you, Comrade Chairman, comrades and friends. Let me begin by making an admission. Maybe I should even say begin by making a confession. To me, there's nothing more exciting than history. Now, maybe that just tells you something about the dullness of my life or whatever, but nothing in the world is more exciting than history, because history is about social motion. It is about the movement of society and being part of that movement. It is about people and how our lives change and why our lives change. It is about social evolution. It is about social revolution and how the plodding pace of social evolution changes periodically and erupts into revolution like a volcano does in nature, and suddenly everything is different. And every hour of the day, every second, we change, our environment changes, there is a constant state of becoming. Everything which stands still is about to move. Everything which is obvious is about to surprise us by becoming different. It's an exciting process to look at history. You can get out of bed in the morning, and if the off button isn't pressed on your mind, you can actually sense that things in the world are changing, that you are not part of a stagnant universe. And I would go as far as to suggest that it is this ability to think historically, to know what happened to ourselves and to our fellow human beings in the past, and to draw conclusions from that in planning what is going to happen next, which makes us human beings and which defines the uniqueness of our consciousness, that we are historical social animals. And that is why it would be pointless to address a group of lemmings about the need to organize for socialism rather than commit suicide, which lemmings have a propensity to do. It would be pointless because they are not historical animals. And that is why we hope there are no lemmings in the audience today. The conservative, And when I say conservative, I mean anyone who is not a social revolutionary, because remember, Neil Kinnock and Mikhail Gorbachev are very faithful conservatives as well. They get out of bed in the morning and the room is stifling with a stale and stagnant atmosphere of nothing moving. Everything is still. Nothing is ever going to happen. You get out of bed in the morning, the Queen is on her throne. She will always be on her throne. She has always been on her throne. Since the world was created, there must have been a queen somewhere on her throne. Until the day the world ends, there must be a queen somewhere on her throne. If the queen wasn't on her throne, how would people deliver the milk? And the workers are destined forever to wage slavery. The bosses will boss forever. For the rest of eternity, there will be an endless cycle of the Terry Wogan show, by-elections in Greenwich, people who haven't got anywhere to live sleep under the arches in Charing Cross, people starve to death, money dominates our life, it goes on forever, and that's life, and that's inevitable, and if you don't like it, then that's history, and that's a fact of life. And then you bring your children up to fear change, because the only thing which makes your miserable existence tolerable is the sure belief that anything different from the way you're living now is going to be catastrophically worse, so you constantly live in fear that things might change in any direction. So when the Conservative wakes up in the morning, he thanks God. He said, I had a terrible nightmare. I thought it was going to be a new day, and there was no boss there to kick me up the arse and put me in my place. Thank goodness, it's still the same as yesterday, and it will always be the same as yesterday. But for the socialist, when they wake up in the morning, and if you ever try phoning a socialist, not all of them wake up in the morning, but if you ever look at what a socialist thinks, and the way a socialist thinks, it is to see the world as something which is moving, and to see society as something which is moving. And it is not moving independently of us. It is, we are part of that movement, and you cannot escape from being part of the movement of society. Because the most elementary lesson of the past is that society does always change. It changes incessantly. Examples. In 1640, Charles I was the king, and he would be the king of England until he died. He was destined to be the king of England. Every single king of England before Charles I had been the king of England because they were put there by God. God was going to save the king. You know the song, God Saves the Queen. There's another version, God Saves the King. And there's another version, the working class have to pay for it. And what happens, therefore, is that as a result of all of this, everyone assumed that it was destiny, it was certain, it was inevitability, this is history, it's a fact of life. And then one day they cut the king's head off, which is a very useful thing to do to a king, and the result of all of this was that Charles I wasn't the king anymore. He was Charles I deceased. So, history changed. My grandfather, he wasn't a king, he was a peasant in Russia. And he had no doubt that he would end his life being a peasant. No doubt about it at all. All of his fellow peasants, if you would have gone up to them and said, you are one day going to live in a state of affairs where you are not going to be tied to your landlord by this feudal sort of obligation to give him a part of the product of what you produce. You are going to be a wage laborer. They would have told you you were mad. And if you went to the Negro slaves in America, when they were owned, physically owned in body, by another human being, and you would have said, you're not always going to be owned by another human being. One day you're not going to be a slave anymore. Ha ha, life's got good things in store for you. You're going to be a wage slave instead. Then they would have said, it's never going to happen. It's impossible. You're a utopian. If you would have told them that, they will tell you you're crazy. And the person who challenges the apparent certainties of history is always regarded as a utopian. But these certainties never last. What is immutable is always transcended. The history of society is littered with the certainties about the past and the future of those people who can only perceive society by looking through the rear view mirror. Now, there is an immense amount of nonsense spoken about history. I know
because I am one of those few people in this country who is actually paid by the government to talk nonsense about history. I am a professional historian, and I do my best not to talk nonsense. I just talk nonsense from 9 to 5 during the day, and then I go home at night, and for the Socialist Party, I tend to occasionally talk a bit of sense to balance things up. Now, there are people, for example, who will tell you history is nothing to do with us. History is nothing to do with ordinary people. History is about people who want to bury themselves in books, bury themselves in the past. History is what has been. So I propose to take a few minutes, only a few minutes, because Janie Percy Smith is going to tell you about Marx's theory of history. I'm not going to talk about it. She's going to tell you it. All I say about Marx's theory of history is Marx's theory of history is right. The opponents of Marx's theory of history were wrong. And if you want to know why, you ask Janie, because Karl Marx isn't going to come here today. So she'll explain it why. But the first myth about history, which I want to deal with, is that there is a beginning and an end to history. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. You all have been told that. Everyone in this room must have been told this insane, absurd proposition. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And he created man on the first day. And then, well, I don't know who he created next. I think woman, and then worms, and then it was a calculator. There's a long scenario, and it's all explained if you read Genesis chapter 1. And this invisible, hyperactive God, in 6 days, he created everything all around us. And we were all brought up to believe in this myth about history. And for most of the past, people actually saw history in terms of this notion of divine creation. I'll give you an example. In the 17th century, Dr. Lightfoot, who was a vice-chancellor of Cambridge University, he wrote a book for students of history. And in it he explained, and I quote, "Man was created by God on the 23rd of October, 4004 BC, at 9 o'clock in the morning." Unquote. He was a vice-chancellor. How stupid you had to be to become the chancellor, Christ only knows. And after God had created the world, he created man, he created women, he created worms, because he created apples, so the whole thing screwed up in the end. Then he works out a design for an eternal pattern of history. So all of history is calculated. Change is ordained by a God who is above us. Now, why do people need to believe that history has been planned for them? That they are the passive victims of an external force which ordains history. Why? Because most people, this is a tragedy. This isn't something to sneer at. This is a tragedy. Most people are unaware of the immense power that resides within them collectively. And because they are unaware of their own power to formulate history, they invent a body outside of themselves. They invent a fiction. They invent a deity, they invent an external force, and they say, that's where the real power is. That is where the power is, and that is going to terrorize us and tell us how we must live. If you see yourself as an infant in a world which is confusing and you've got no idea of what's going on, then you invent for yourself a holy father, and that holy father will make decisions for you. And the philosopher Schopenhauer summed it up. I quote what he said. "A certain amount of general ignorance is the condition of all religions. It is the element in which alone they can exist. Perhaps a time is approaching when religion will take her departure from humanity, like a nurse which the child has outgrown. The child will now be given over to a tutor, for there is no doubt that religious doctrines which are founded merely on authority, miracles and revelations, are only suited to the childhood of humanity." So the first myth, which must be exploded if we are going to comprehend history, is that it is determined independently of our action. That it is a product of a God. That it is a product of something called human nature. That it's a product of something called the iron laws of history. It's not the product of any of those things. In reality, the forces determining history stand neither above nor outside of us, but we are part of them. Myth number two about history is that history is like a big film in which there are a few big stars and there are a lot of insignificant extras. And you want to know who the insignificant extras are? You. And the stars are the ruling class, the great men of history, And the wealth producers are the extras who stand about doing useless things, like they create wealth, they sweep the streets, they drive the buses, they kill each other in wars, and that is the job of the extras. That is capitalist history. The history of men who are great because they own and control the world, and the rest who are small because they are just in attendance on history. They are just on the sidelines of history. That is the capitalist notion of history. And remember, every time you hear a historian talking about the great man in history, you must also remember that what they are also talking about are the little men in history, the insignificant people in history, because that's the converse of that argument. So you go to school, as happened to most of us as an infliction when we were young, and you learn that Henry VIII had six wives. And this is history. Henry VIII had six wives. I'm very glad. I'm sorry he didn't have seven. Ah, and Churchill defeated Hitler. So it was two of them, like Lloyd Hannigan in the ring with that American. Two rounds, Churchill defeats Hitler. And Lenin brought down the Tsar. Ah, but Trotsky helped him. Ah, no wonder they brought down the Tsar. It was two of them working as a team. One of them must have come up in front and said, boo, the other one jumped on him from behind. So this is how revolutions happen. This is history. And history then is one long parade of people marching in front of us, who are these great men, these leaders. And behind them are marching these little, insignificant, nameless, faceless, ant-like creatures. And they are the working class, the peasants, the slaves, your ancestors. That is history as far as they are concerned. And there's nothing to be learnt from that sort of history. Nothing to be learnt from it at all, except for the simple lesson that whoever has got enough historians on his payroll becomes a great man. So, if you can afford to hire 50 historians to write books about you, I can assure you, you'll be a great man. If I could afford to buy 50 artists, I'd be a beautiful man and have my picture in the National Portrait Gallery. Now, the story, which is more important to history, is not about kings or about queens or about generals or about dictators or about presidents. The really important story of history is not about these people, but it is about how ordinary people, I hate that term, ordinary people, because it means that we are not extraordinary people, we're people with one head and two arms and things like that. How people throughout history have gone out and made a living, how they've made things, how they've produced things, how they've created things, how they've managed to satisfy their needs, what ideas they've had about improving their lives. And what I think the socialist has to say about this is very simple. Let the robbers and the oppressors study their history, and let the workers study our history. And both classes will arrive at different conclusions about history. The bosses will view history, as they always have, with a view of arrogance and pride that they have succeeded, and amazement that they've succeeded. When the boss reads history, he says, how the hell did we succeed? How the hell, over all of these hundreds of years, has a small minority of people who do nothing, many of them have never moved a muscle from the day that they were born until the day that they retire to the House of Lords, how did this small minority of people govern the vast majority of people? Well, the answer that they arrive at is that they have to con people as long as they can. But for the worker, once the worker studies history, workers discover who the suckers have been, who's been taken in, who has allowed themselves to be fooled by this minority and to work for that minority. And this leads me on to the third and final myth about history that I must mention before I sit down. And that myth, the chairman has already touched on it, is that history is somehow academic. We all sit in silence in a library and we study for years to discover the exact decade when feudalism came to an end, because we must know when feudalism came to an end so that we can know when capitalism started, and we must know what capitalism started because the working class are waiting to find out when it started so they can put an end to it. And this is what history is all about. And I must accuse historians of the right, historians of the left, all kinds of people, historians who call themselves Marxists, they all go in for this time-wasting, futile pursuit of studying history for its own sake. No significance in it at all. So-called Marxist historians, I'll give you an example in my own field. So-called Marxist historians have spent years studying the question, was Marx a Hegelian? To what extent was Marx influenced by Hegel in developing his theory of history? And people sit for years and years and years in libraries. They go to the British Museum, Oxford University, Cambridge University, London University, sitting in the libraries, write books, 400 pages, £20 to buy the book, to find out, was Marx influenced by Hegel? They're waiting on the Bounsbury estate before they're going to agree to socialism to find out whether Marx was influenced by Hegel. They agree with every other aspect of the case for socialism, but they want to know that answer. As far as they're concerned, Marx could have been influenced by Bruce Forsyth. It doesn't matter. What's significant is why ideas at a certain time are come about. Now, what did Marx say about all this? This is the point. In 1845, Marx said the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. And what did Marx also say in his critique of Hegel's philosophy of right? He wrote, and this is very important, every person should recognize the significance of this comment. Theory becomes a material force as soon as it has gripped the people. In other words, if ideas are going to play any part in changing history, then they are not going to change history while they belong and are the exclusive possession of a minority of people who call themselves intellectuals or leaders or the Leninist vanguard or whatever other people claim that they are going to appropriate the ideas of history. It is only when people who are part and parcel of the day-to-day struggle of history, the struggle to exist within the society, recognize what is happening to them historically. It is when millions of people wake up in indignant realization and the exciting knowledge that things can be different, that history can actually be made by them. It is then that they can create a different society. And this will be when the working class becomes historical, when the working class recognizes that we, the vast majority of people in the world who do everything useful in the world, the people who have made the world the way that it is, when it is recognized that we have got the power to make tomorrow fundamentally different from today, that is like a giant who has recognized his own strength, which he hadn't recognized for hundreds of years. It will, in fact, be the appropriation of human beings of their own consciousness, and it will mean that we will end the prehistory of humanity, where the majority of people have been excluded from the making of history, and the beginning of the dawn of history, where people, as a majority, make our own history. And that, it seems to me, is the relevance of history to socialists today.